I got a buddy, he's like, man, I don't even know what to do. I'm alone. My wife left me. I don't know what to do with myself. I'm like, listen to the Tainted Glove podcast. You'll be fine. He goes, nah, I'll just get a hooker. Thanks, though. Yeah, dog.
Time for The Tainted Glove, starring your favorite man of questionable character, Aloha Mr. Hand.
Hey, bud. Let's party.
And the Holy Reverend K. Fitz himself. It's go time, so grab a beer, grab a bite, and settle in. It's time for The Tainted Glove.
Aloha, and welcome to this week's edition of The Tainted Glove. I am your host, Aloha, Mr. Hand, and just joining me now is the co-host, the Honorable Reverend K. Fitz. Lost you there for a second. I don't know what happened. But
weird.
Today is Sunday, September 11th. We, of course, remember the events of 21 years ago today and always keep those people in our thoughts and our prayers. But we also are in a victory formation because the Bears won today. And with that, K. Fitz, take it away.
Yeah, a whole bunch of positivity today. We got optimism on the south side. We've got optimism on the north side. And as a collective, despite the gloomy rain and torrential downpour coming from the skies above, Bears fans are pretty joyful today. So there's a little silver lining, a touch of gray, if you will, for my man Zoe's favorite, one of his favorite bands, Grateful Dead. A little touch of gray there today. Everything looked pretty good today, so it's great. So thanks for tuning in, guys. We appreciate you. We know that there's some football going on TV right now, but it's the Cowboys, so you know you guys are probably just, you know, and Chris Collinsworth.
The Buccaneers are going
to
win.
And Chris Collinsworth has some sort of chest cold, so honestly, listening to him makes you want to clear your throat constantly, so better to listen to us anyway. Neither of us sound like we're we're smoking four packs a day since we were four. So
check with me tomorrow. That might be different.
Could be tomorrow, but not now. So, but we do appreciate you tuning in here on this Sunday night. Yes, and like Pete said too, on September 11th, obviously you want to keep that in mind as today is a solemn reminder of something that happened. It's unbelievable. 21 years ago. 21 years ago. It just is, to me, is insane. But
and I still remember where I was.
Me too. I was sleeping in my bed. Because I was on the West Coast, because it was only like 6 in the morning when everything started happening, 6 in the morning. And my mom came in.
About 6 o'clock in the morning your time.
Yep. And I remember my mom had come in, because again, I was just barely out of college. I was just barely home from college. A plane had crashed on the lawn of the White House a couple weeks earlier. It was one of those like little mini like crap planes that are just like the two-seaters. And I was like, so she said, oh yeah, a plane hit the World Trade Center. And that's what I thought immediately was, oh, like someone hit like a two-seater. Well, that's terrible. And then obviously everything unfolded the way that it did. And probably the longest day I think I've ever been tuned into a television and consuming mass amounts of media and news. And that was probably my first lesson in the dangers of overconsumption of media. Cause that night in the middle of the night, actually I was sleeping with my ex and, she had a nightmare, and I swear to God, I woke up in the middle of the night thinking someone was on top of her. And so I ended up karate chopping like air, basically out of bed, punching and thinking something was happening. I was like completely, my mind had been so wrapped up in all that stuff. We were expecting it to happen again. We were so sure it was going to happen again in a day or two. Like we were resolved to a new reality of this is the world that we live in. And, you know, lucky enough, we really have had none of that type of terrorism since. We've had other types, but it's been a really weird, interesting run. But I know, I think I can really go back probably more than anything else. And I remember that at one point, we can actually pinpoint, there was a moment where in this country, everybody stood together as one for real, at least for a couple weeks until politics got back into everything. But that was a really, you know, a sad but special moment. You know, it shouldn't take that kind of pain to bring everybody together, but it was the most unified I've ever experienced our country from all sides, as opposed to like maybe just one or two sides. And so that was a learning experience. And I will,
yes. And I'll add one thing. I have been to the 9/11 Museum in New York. I did do a tour of it early 2020. Actually, I was in New York for the Derek Jeter Hall of Fame press conference. And I stayed an extra day and I did a tour of the 9/11 museum. What I'll say about it is this. I will never go in there again. But I think every single American citizen should go through there and understand what happened and what these people had to deal with. Like I said, I've been in there. I am not going to describe some of the things I've seen. 20 years later, there were still raw emotions because it was obvious to me that one woman had a relative who died that day with the way she was carrying on looking at his picture, because one of the rooms in the museum has pictures of every victim from that day. Every victim. And it was obvious that she lost someone that day. And it's something, like I said, I think every American citizen should see. I think every American citizen should pay their respects to, but I'll never go back in there.
Makes sense. It's kind of like going to the Holocaust Museum as well. Like,
yes.
Just going to Auschwitz is something that, while it's not something you really want to do, it's almost something that you feel compelled that you should do, because it's a reminder that there is, you know, evil in this world, but there is also, you know, the ability for us as a species to overcome even the worst of circumstance together, if we are together, that is, obviously.
Right. And speaking of overcoming, the mighty bear, bear down, 1-0.
And they didn't even run a T formation today.
They didn't. They ran a victory formation, though.
Absolutely.
And then did a slip and slide into the end zone.
Fantastic, by the way. That's my favorite new. That's probably my favorite Bears clip since the Bears interception for a touchdown. Was it rowing? Did they do rowing, I think, for the camera in the end zone?
Yes.
A couple years ago when I think it was probably 2017. But so what we're talking about, obviously, is Bears today opened up their season against the San Francisco 49ers. Massive overdogs. Yes, I put my money where my mouth was last night and threw $100 on the Bears to win money line. Absolutely did. And the Bears.
Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. Were you drunk?
Absolutely. I had a little bit of liquid courage in me. That's for sure. I had some buddies that were talking trash, a couple of Niners fans. And I'm like, I'm gonna put my money where my mouth is here. And I didn't expect the weather to be like it. Well, I mean, when I saw the weather today, I got actually way more stoked about my bet when I saw the conditions out there, because it was rainy, muddy. It looked like soup. It did look like chocolate soup out there, basically. And again, they just put that new sod down after the preseason game a couple weeks ago, where it was basically like a dust bowl after a concert. So
No, they put it down this week because they had Ramstein there in concert last Saturday night.
Oh, okay. But during the preseason game, it was already just terrible.
That sod's not even a week old. Yeah.
Did they just hurt Tom Brady? Did the Cowboys just hurt Tom Brady? Oh, okay. I thought that was Tom Brady. It's just a lineman. Okay. But today, 19-10, missed a couple extra points. But again, I'm going to blame the soupy mud because Cairo Santos has been fantastic.
And a field goal.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. He missed a field goal too, huh?
And a field goal.
Rough day to kick today. But the Bears, I mean, and again, if you didn't watch the game, though, the Bears, I mean, at one point, I think midway through the second quarter, they had 23 total yards. It was not going well. They couldn't get off the line. No. They were getting beat. San Francisco was playing fantastic defense, constantly in the backfield. And the Bears defense managed to keep Trey Lance and that San Francisco offense in check for the most part, other than, one touchdown and a field goal. It was a 10-0 game, basically, heading into the half. And was it 10-0 or 7-0? I can't remember. I think it was 10-0. No, it was 7-0. They kicked a field goal on the first drive out of the half.
Yes.
Made it 10-0.
Yes.
So it was a close enough game. You figure at home in that kind of weather, you keep it close enough, you kind of survive a little bit. It's the first year, Matt Eberflus's first time as a head coach, his first game. All this new stuff is going out. Luke Getsy's calling his first game. And it felt like they were just persistently just willing to not make mistakes and just kind of feeling it out almost. And then the second half rolls around. There's a broken play. Justin Fields gets out, breaks a couple tackles and finds himself, spinning around for dear life. And all of a sudden, next thing you know, Pettis is wide open and he, Justin Fields flings it off, across his body. It's wide open, big 50-yard touchdown reception, and all of a sudden things just changed in the ball game. Bears get the ball back, another touchdown on another really well thrown ball. Field starts running, they start moving the ball a little bit, they start rolling them out a little more, couple actually called runs. all of a sudden you start seeing the offense slowly getting there. Now, you know, Mooney and Cole Kmet today were basically no shows. Those guys will show up in regular conditions. I think that the conditions today, I think it was more important that Kmet blocked well today for him. So staying in the trenches. And then I think that Mooney and what Mooney does well, it just doesn't play well and translate into, you know, with wet field conditions. He's a speed cut guy. So it's really hard for him to do what he does best, but that's fine. Guys got open and again, the Bears ended up putting the game away and they went 19-10. The defense showed up, got a nice big, almost another pick six from Eddie Jackson. Hey, ghost Eddie Jackson comes back finally. The young pups on defense had some fantastic plays. I think there was a forced fumble at one point, a recovered fumble by, Brisker?
Brisker, yes.
Yeah, and then they had the sack by Robinson. Is it Robinson? Is his name Robinson?
Was it Robinson or Quinn?
The rookie, Robinson.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, he had a sack too. So you see this stuff start happening. So the Bears came out, and obviously in those conditions, they win the game. And yeah, the big dive into the end zone with the guys are sliding on the water. It was just perfect finish. So the Bears are in first place. Only making this day better is the fact that Aaron Rodgers, without Devontae Adams today, looked like Clark Kent had been basically anally probed with kryptonite and was useless. Aaron Rodgers was useless. The Packers offense was useless. The Packers in general were useless. They got boat raced by the Vikings. It looked good. And the Bears are currently now sitting atop first place in the division, along with, of course, the Detroit Lions won today, too. No, the Lions lost.
No, Lions lost. Lions, the Vikings won.
Yeah, Vikings won. So the Vikings beat the Packers. So it's a good start. It's a good start for Justin Fields and what we really consider to be year one of Justin Fields for real, because he's finally it's his show. It's not the Matt Nagy show. And we found a bunch of those whys on the field today that Matt Nagy had been looking for years. We found the why. And the why was Matt Nagy, apparently, because Luke Getsy did a great job of persistently finding ways to keep the ball out of the opponent's hand as best as possible. And then finally, when they found stuff that worked, really attacked and attacked what worked. And that is adaptivity. Stuff that we didn't see from Matt Nagy in the last 4 or 5 years was Nagy came out with like basically 20 scripted plays, and then the adaptivity in the second half was non-existent. In this case, this was the exact opposite. They were like velociraptors testing the fence for vulnerabilities. And when they finally found the vulnerability, the Bears attacked. And they were the better team in the second half of this ballgame after being told that they're the worst team in the NFL all offseason. And here we are. So what were your thoughts, Pete? You know, how are you feeling good?
In the spirit of full disclosure, I was at the game today. So I wasn't privy to a lot of the TV replays and things of that nature and the commentary, but just my impressions from being there. I will say this, the grass held up very well considering it had just been laid down this week. But I have a couple pictures I'll post later of what the field looked like after the game was over. And if you saw those pictures from Cleveland a couple weeks ago of the Cleveland warning track, that's sort of what the Bears field looked like. And at one point, jump to your question, Wally was there, not Walter. At one point, before the game started, actually, they were squeegeeing the field, like pushing water off of the field onto the sidelines. It was one of the funniest things to ever see. And to your point, you know, I'll also add the first half, let's call it what it was. They looked awful. They looked terrible. The defense looked pretty good. It was holding its own. A couple of opportune turnovers, you know, really helped out. Some very undisciplined play by San Francisco really helped out. I think they finished with 13 or 14 penalties, and the Bears only had 3, which watching this Bears team versus the Nagy era, it was remarkable. We got to 2 minutes in the first half, and I turned to Wally and I said, they haven't called a timeout yet. This is a small victory in itself. Because usually you'd get the too many men on the field timeout, or the they couldn't get the play in on time timeout, or the timeout after a timeout because they don't know what play to call. So it was great to see that they weren't that they had a plan. That's the thing I keep coming back to. They were prepared. Mm-hmm. They had a plan. Yes, maybe the plan wasn't working as effectively as you would like in the first half, but they had a plan and they stuck to it.
Yep.
Now, you know, it's kind of hard to truly judge them from this game because the weather conditions just made it such a tough go of it. And mm-hmm. and that applies to both teams. You know, usually I'm a guy who wants to see, I think you have to pass to set up the run. That's just my personal preference. Pass to set up the run, because if you get the pass game established, they have to play back more. So then you can run the ball. Not this run to set up the pass, because if you run to set up the pass, basically you got six or seven guys crashing in on you. Even if you establish run, you still got six or seven guys crashing in on you going after the quarterback with the ball. The other way, pass to set up the run, they have to stay back a little bit more because you've established that you can get the ball out and throw. But I know a lot of people don't agree with me on that. Hey, whatever. Fan how you want to fan. But the first half offense, and to Yumper's point, it looked like John Shoup was calling it or something, because it was it almost looked like the Walter Payton offense in the early 80s. You know, hand off right, hand off left, hand off up the middle, punt. Hand off right, hand off left, hand off up the middle, punt. But what I think they were doing, they were, to your point earlier, they were probing, like, where are we seeing some softness in the coverage?
Mm-hmm.
And they did something else that we never saw in the Matt Nagy era. They adjusted at halftime.
Yep.
It was amazing to see the adjustments at halftime, because once the second half started, that's when you saw a field start to roll out, you know, and he took that one run for, it was like one 20-yard run, I want to say, that he had in there.
Yeah. Yep.
So it was refreshing to see that there was actually a cohesive plan throughout the game and discipline throughout the game.
Yep. And you know what I noticed too? How many times did we feel like under Matt Nagy, they were getting these plays in so late, and there was a yes. unnecessary timeouts because they're not even getting in the huddle until there's like, you know, 7 seconds left to go on the play clock. Or that didn't happen at all today.
No.
And I did, you know, and Yumper, you know, he's in the chat right now talking about it too,
yeah.
joking about that being like a John Shoup offense in the first half. And yeah, we threw a lot of slip screens and halfback passes. And I'm like, that seems interesting. But then in watching the Packers game today, I think that's just the offensive scheme itself does that quite frequently. I think because, I mean, Aaron Jones and Corey Dillon were getting dump after dump after dump. It's just, I don't know if it's a check down thing or what within the offense, but I think that was kind of like, that's the safety valve. And I think that they were just using that safety valve. And I really do feel like he was just kind of feeling it out a little bit and letting, it's kind of like Rocky taking a couple punches from the Russian to tire the Russian out a little bit, or, you know, or tire Clubber Lang out and then figure out the vulnerability.
He did it with Mr. T too.
Yeah, he did.
Clubber Lang.
Good old Clubber. Yeah. And so,
yeah.
He's so bad. And so, you know, all of that stuff comes into that hits principle, right? We talked about this before we went on. Matt Eberflus has a hits principle system. H is for hustle. I is intensity. T for takeaway. And then S is in playing smart. And so when you have these types of concepts, and it's in essence what he's pushing, is that you want guys to play 100 through the whistle. You got one of guys playing with that deep intensity. And you want, you know, short fields, create short fields.
Yes.
And that's something that makes a good team better offensively, is when you can give. And today in the first half, the Bears had a horrible field position the entire first half. Yeah. They were inside their 20 most of the day until the second half. And when they were finally able to kind of break out of that, you could see the offense kind of opening it up a little bit too, once it had some breathing room to operate. And so I think that's a big part of it. The takeaways, seeing Eddie Jackson get that pick and almost getting a pick six out of it too. Again, that Peanut Tillman punch by that was Johnson that punched it out, right? And then
I believe so.
Brisker then picked up the fumble or whatever. And so you got that. And then playing smart, like you said, no penalty. Like, I mean, being penalized three times in a ball game and that rain and all that gunk, when they were playing, they were calling it pretty tight. I mean, the broadcasting crew said it a bunch of times during the broadcast that they were calling it tight. And to only have three or four penalties in a game that they were calling tight is a testament to the discipline of the S part, the playing smart.
And one of those penalties was on something I never saw before. I didn't even know it was a rule.
The towel.
On the, the towel. On the field goal with the towel. Yes. I didn't even know. I didn't even understand that when they called it. I'm like, what the hell is he talking about? The only way I understood it was I listened to the driving home. I listened to one of the post game shows and they explained it. I'm like, that's a dumb rule, but unfortunately, it's a rule. I just think it might have been put in place after the snowplow incident in New England in, like, what, 1982 or whatever it was?
Could be.
Where the guy plowed out a portion of the field for the kicker to have a clear footing. That's the only thing I can think of, that it was a result of that particular play 40 years ago.
Yeah, well, it was weird, and it cost the Bears 3 points because it knocked them out of field goal range. But that was just
it was a personal foul.
Yeah,
15 yards.
Mm-hmm. So that one almost you almost want to say, "Well, I who cares? Nobody, none of us knew what the hell that was." So
right.
So, but then you see a lot of the other stuff too. You know, you got guys; these are more veterans, St. Brown and Pettis, for example, guys that have played with. You know, I mean, Pettis is coming over from, or is it Pringle? Pringle came over from Kansas. Pettis was with the 49ers last year. And then you have St. Brown was with the Packers. So you've got these guys coming from places where they've had pretty good offensive coaching, whether it was with a quarterback or whether it was at, like, you know, someone like, what's his name, the head coach in there in San Francisco. So you've got good IQs for some of the veterans. They're not the burners. They're not these, you know, and, you know, the guy that I was really excited to see, today ended up being inactive, which was, the kid from, Tennessee. What's his name? Vilas. Vilas Jones.
Vilas, yes.
But he was out with a hammy, I think. So that was a rather disappointing, but
yeah.
It's good to see us again. It's good to see Bears football back. You know, it's good to wake up on a Sunday morning and here in the West Coast, it was the game of the week. It was favorite. I was lucky. It's playing a West Coast team. So I get a chance to watch the Bears on TV. I didn't have to go, hit the Reddit links or, you know, start downloading weird viruses to my computer just so I could watch the Bears. And I didn't have to go spend, you know, $50 eating at a bar. So, again, it's a nice thing to have that opportunity. You know, obviously I don't want to pay for the NFL ticket either. I'm not home enough, but, I'm a cheapskate, but it was good to see the Bears back. It's good to see. And then again, the Bears won and the NFL, you know, and the Bears next game will be next Sunday night right now, a week from tonight, on Sunday Night Football at Lambeau against the Packers. I will say this, if the Bears somehow go into Lambeau next Sunday night and they beat the Packers and they hit them right in the mouth, and with the way the defense played today and as bad as I saw Aaron Rodgers and that offense look today with a mediocre Vikings defense, it's theoretically possible if that Bears offense plays well. And I am I can say this, if the Bears win next Sunday night, you can expect the Bears to maybe rattle off a very good start to the season. I think, you know, in the NFL, 2 weeks winning the first two games of the season is just weird magic that just festers, just like a bad start festers. A good start like this in the league, it gets teams going. It's where teams of destiny become teams of destiny. So the first 2 weeks of the season, all of a sudden that positivity reigns supreme, you know, and then you go, you know, maybe you go three in a row. That's like almost a whole month of not losing and everything just seems to start figuring out, start working together. And teams that all of a sudden are like come out of nowhere, quote unquote, that were always there, they just were underrated, start showing up. And so it'll be pretty cool to see what happens next week. I don't think Justin Fields is going in there scared. I don't think that this Bears team is going to go in there scared. They just beat a far superior San Francisco team that the Packers can never beat. and that's the last team. That's the team that ended the Packers last year. I mean, this is a team that went to the NFC title game. I mean, this is not a chump team that the Bears beat today. It wasn't a poor team. It was a quality win in week one. Like, that's fantastic. That's a team that is a better team than Green Bay. And so curious to see how this plays out. But week one, positivity.
That's right. And I'll just say this. I was shocked at how undisciplined the 49ers looked. To me, it looked like they were almost stunned that how are we behind this team? We're supposed to be Super Bowl contenders. They're supposed to be the worst team in the league. How are we losing to them? It looked like at the end, and again, let me say this, at the end, you really can't expect an A-plus game plan from either team because it was horseshit out there. Mm-hmm. I was shocked that I having felt the football when it's wet, it's very slick. And yes, generally quarterbacks have much bigger hands than most people. That's part of the reason why they're a quarterback, because they can hold the thing. But trying to throw that ball in this weather with the wind, because the wind was a factor too. The wind was a factor too. Is a very tough task in today, in the elements, especially in the fourth quarter. Like I said, it opened up in the fourth quarter.
It did. When, as soon as the Bears took that 9-point lead, it felt like the gods just said, "Ha!" And then
yeah,
we saw the video of the video of that 49ers fan just standing underneath the leaking roof, and it's just pouring into his popcorn, and he's just sitting there like, fuck my life. Like, it's great. It's a perfect microcosm for Niners fans, because Niners fans thought they were going to roll in there and just, you know, roll over the Bears. I mean, all offseason, we've heard how the Bears are the worst team in the league.
Yes.
And this obviously kills that narrative now. You can't be the worst team in the league and win in the, you know, and beat the San Francisco 49ers in week one and be the worst team in the league. There's plenty of teams much worse.
Right. And it's just funny because one tip, I think somebody who was at the game with me, not me, learned in a game like when you have weather like it was today, wear black pants. I'm just going to throw that out there. Wear black pants. Because if you're wearing other colors, there might be questions about how did your pants get wet? That's all I'll say.
This is washing my hands. That's all. Sprinkles from the hand washing station. It just had really high water pressure. That's all it was. It was not sprinkles, I promise.
But yes, I got in the car coming home. The heated, I felt like I was 80 years old. The heated seat went on in the car. I had to take the poncho I had on off and put it in the back seat. And I'm driving. I got the heat on. I got the heated seat on. I'm like, Jesus Christ, I'm fucking 80.
And yeah, you said you had to go home and take a shower just to warm up. Yes. That's the worst. What a throw by Tom Brady.
Yes.
Holy,
that's why he's the GOAT.
Smokes. His receiver's hurt now, but, and Godwin, looks like Godwin already left. It looks like Godwin re-injured his ACL. That sucks.
Yeah. But no, that is a hell of a,
you know what, Jack, and you say this, but there are some exceptions. He says you do get a free pass to do whatever wearing black pants, except if you spill ranch or blue cheese.
Or something else that's white.
True. Heavy petting in black pants. Mm-hmm. Bad mix.
Yes.
So things to always keep in mind.
Yes, that is true.
At our age, for some reason.
But as far as the Bears, the field after the game left something to be desired. When, like I said, when you looked at it, it looked like the Cleveland warning track from a couple weeks ago when they got all that rain. The grass held up surprisingly well. There were no giant, like, chunks missing from, you know, tackles or people skidding or anything like that. It held up remarkably well, but they need to put some kind of drainage system in there because it was insane. And again, there was a shitload of rain that fell in a really quick time. So I understand that, but they need to do something.
Yeah, I mean, it looked like diarrhea.
Yes.
Literally.
Yep.
So I just learned something totally just now from my dad just texted me. Apparently, Zach McKistry, I think he's playing second for the Cubs tonight, is apparently a distant relative. Apparently he's
a
cousin's brother-in-law. So, I don't know what that means. It means absolutely nothing, but,
I'm your father's uncle's brother's
best friend's former roommate. What does that mean? Absolutely nothing. But So in that weird 18 degrees of separation, apparently I've got some sort of weird connection to him. So that's cool. Root for him. Go woohoo. Anyway, speaking of baseball, though.
Yes.
Yeah. That means I'm going to start defending him just blindly at this point. It doesn't even matter what he does. I will defend him and you will go down. You will not talk about Bruno. So we got the Bears, got some optimism, some high positivity. And that kind of transitions us over to the next part, segment of the show, which is the next necessary positivity, which has been the White Sox. The White Sox, Tony La Russa had to step away, 10 days ago or so, with some issues with his pacemaker. He has not been with the team, but in the time that he's been gone, the White Sox have played some solid baseball. They've been scoring a lot of runs. I can't remember the exact record after today without him. I think it was 8-4. Is that what it is or something like that?
It's 8-4 or 9-4.
Something like that.
Something like that.
Like a +5, +4, +5 wins over losses, split. And so you've got all this positivity coming in. You know, they've got it down to 2.5 games. They actually had it down to what? They had it down to,
it was down to 1.5 yesterday.
Yeah, it's down to 1.5 yesterday. So really, just really there. And then obviously the White Sox lost today, but I mean, it was 3-4. It took 3-4 on the road in Oakland, where they have 7 fans that show up. And 2 of them they actually wandered into the wrong part of the ballpark. They were there for a convention in the back. But
and a 5-2 West Coast road trip.
Yep.
Take those every single time.
Mm-hmm. Like the old circus trip for the Bulls,
especially with
right?
the house of horrors that Oakland has been in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's positivity there. And so now, as we head into the final 3 weeks of this regular season, the White Sox are 2.5 games back tonight as of airtime with us. They're off tomorrow, Monday. The Guardians have a game. They start a series with the Angels. The White Sox then pick up Tuesday with the Rockies, a pair of games with the Rockies, who have won 4 of 5, by the way. They're actually playing pretty decent baseball right now. And so with this, it's a stretch run. I mean, I think the Sox have 4 games with the Guardians still, so that they hold their own destiny in that sense. Yeah, the Twins did nothing. The best case scenario was the Twins won that series, and they didn't. The Twins have completely fallen off. I still think that the Indians have peaked. I just think that the Twins are just that much worse. And so that's the only reason that they couldn't, you know, it's like just 2 teams that aren't playing great baseball right now playing each other. Someone's got to win. It can't be a tie. So that's...
Well, and the Twins lost Buxton, which I think is they've lost their catalyst.
They have. And so you've got this positivity. So if Pete, I mean, from here, we go from positivity of a Bears game, you know, Bears win opening day. We have now the White Sox within 2.5 games, you know, whichever way you swing it, whatever happens tomorrow, at the least, there'll be 3 games out going into Tuesday's series with the short series with the Rockies. You know, optimism has gone up and down. All the stuff with Tony La Russa being gone. Should he not be here? People being cruel. Some people just, you know, making just silly jokes. It's fine. Making jokes about it. Things are fine. Just put people wishing death is not fine. So if, you know, you can make jokes about death. That's totally cool. You know, be dark as you want, but it's been a weird kind of couple of weeks because, you know, today it was announced that, you know, yesterday it was announced that he was going to be there today for the game because it's Dave Stewart's, they were honoring Dave Stewart before the game, one of La Russa's old players. But he wasn't coaching, wasn't managing. And they said that they're not entirely sure what the final scoop is going to be with him getting back in the dugout. But it seems to be, all signs seem to point for him returning to the dugout. So let's not dig into that one just yet, because I know that's a really touchy one. But right here, right now, you know, the White Sox are at the worst 3 games out in the last 2-3 weeks stretch. You know, this, you're right in it.
Mm-hmm.
Optimistically wise, we do this on the Pinwheels and Ivy every Wednesday night too. We do like on a scale of 1 to 10. Where are you? Where are you positivity wise? If 10 being like you've got your head in the clouds and everything is puppy dogs and ice cream and it's the greatest thing ever. 1 being, oh shit, here we go again. World sucks. Where are you roughly right now on your optimism scale? If you were to grade yourself, and what are some things that would increase that? And what are some things that maybe you see that might decrease that on the flip side?
Okay. On the optimism scale, there was only 1 point where I reached a 10. That was October 26, 2005. That's when I reached the 10. Where am I at right now? I am probably at a 5.5 to 6, and I'll explain why. All this winning is great. It's nice to see winning baseball. It's pleasurable to watch.
But you have four games against the Indians. You've played like shit against the Indians this year. If you do not win those games, nothing else matters. You have to finish with a better record than the Indians because there is no game 163. That has been eliminated in favor of head-to-head competition. And guess who has the edge on head-to-head competition? It is not the White Sox. It is Cleveland. So you have to win three out of those four games. Preferably you win all four, but you have to win three out of four at a minimum and still hope for luck. Because also remember, the final six games of the season, the White Sox go to San Diego for three, and then they come back home and have the Twins for three. Now you think the Twins, who are pretty close to being eliminated, they're not out of it yet, but they're closer than the White Sox are to being eliminated, would like nothing more than to eliminate the White Sox, especially at home at Guaranteed Rate Field. While the Guardians play six games at home against the Royals, you have to be ahead of them. There is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You waited too long for this. You kept we kept hearing a reset. Oh, it's early, it's early. This is why it's early is bullshit. You're going to fall, you're going to lose this division by a game or two. That's my honest opinion because I would love to see them beat the Indians or the Guardians. Sorry.
It's hard habit to
break. But I don't
see it. I do it all the time.
Yeah, I know. And what and I'm bringing up La Russa in this because he factors in this. After the game today, there were people tweeting, oh, the Sith Lord was in the stadium. That's why the White Sox lost. Give me a fucking break. Okay? I get it. You don't like La Russa. That's fine. Use fucking common sense. The La Russa hatred, in my opinion, has become irrational.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely irrational.
And, you know, the guy had a pacemaker put in, and his quote, he was interviewed about it today, and his quote was, it's up to the doctors to decide when he can return. This isn't a fucking game. This is a man's life. And he's not going to return until, and you don't even know if it'll happen, until the doctors clear him. Mm-hmm. Frankly, from a personal standpoint, I hope the doctors don't clear him. Not because I think, you know, having him in the dugout is bad juju or anything like that, but he's a fucking human being. It would be a shitty way to go to die on the fucking bench from a heart attack.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, here's the thing.
Over a fucking game.
And that's the bigger picture mentality. I mean, it's sometimes I think the game or the spotlight or whatever just gets too bright for certain people and they just can't handle like being, I mean, I guess maybe it's just unhealthy for some people mentally, I think, to be a fan sometimes. And yes. I think that they get blinded by the enormity of it all. And they make something, which is a game, out to be something more than it's not life or death. It's mm-hmm. baseball, man. It's a pastime, not a, you know, there's so many things about it. And, you know, we've seen it kind of, you know, we've seen it firsthand how ugly it can get, especially on, you know, the cesspool of Twitter. You know, you got, mm-hmm. there's low cogs everywhere and meatballs and, you know, meatballs are going to meatball and people that have hate in their heart are going to hate, and, you know, they're going to extol that hate in their heart. And, you know, there's good things and redeeming qualities about it. And there's negative qualities about it. But in the end, you know, I look at this whole situation with Tony La Russa and baseball players are creatures of habit. They are superstitious. They believe something. And and I can tell you this with my experience as a ball player and my experience coaching ball players over a lifetime, baseball players are a completely different beast than any other sports or athletes. They grab onto anything that they believe might be the reason why. I mean, if you believe that pulling out your pocket, your back right pocket before you go hit helps you hit better because it gives you some weird juju, then guess what? It does. It's what you believe, you make it true. And baseball players, more than anything else, they latch onto this stuff. And so that's the thing, the big part about this whole thing with them playing good baseball with La Russa gone, you know, and I've tweeted a few times, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, and this is the hard part about this decision is Tony La Russa has to have some self-awareness. The White Sox themselves, the players have to have some self-awareness, and the fans never have self-awareness ever. And that's what makes them fans, fanatics. And you have a whole situation where, you know, La Russa coming back, I can tell you firsthand now that I've know someone that has spoken from that locker room and they like Tony La Russa. Like, he's not hated in there. It's not some old cadre coming in there and like, oh shit, the old man's back. Fuck, here goes fun. They fucking love him in there. I can tell you that for a fact. So all you fans that think these guys are just secretly saying stuff to the press because who's going to tell the press that they don't like their boss? It's not true. These are guys that are telling people on the side when they don't have to worry about it going public that they like Tony La Russa. There's nothing to benefit for quietly telling someone else on the side that you're a big fan of Tony La Russa and the locker room likes him. So that tells me a lot. So I'll just, you know, put it that way. It's not someone that's been in that locker room a ton this year, but it's someone that's in that locker room pretty frequently now, especially now. And it just goes to show, but that being said, you know, they're winning. And if they believe that winning for Tony La Russa without Tony La Russa being in the locker room, I can't argue for him being back in the locker room unless the guys aren't, you know, again, everybody, you're going to find a rallying cry. If it's win one for the Gipper, if it's, you know,
win one for Tony,
us against the world, whatever the hell you're rallying behind that's working. If it happened to be that they rallied behind win one for Tony, let's win this for Tony. You know, then Tony's got to kind of be a little self-aware and know where to step back. Now, if he wants to come back, he has the right to come back. And if he comes back, Miguel Cairo is finally doing his job. This is the job that Miguel Cairo was expected to do the minute he was signed and hired as the assistant head coach, as the bench coach. He is bench coaching now. He's showing emotion. He's letting the guys know. This is what he was supposed to be doing the whole time, though. And he wasn't doing this job, but now that La Russa is out, all of a sudden he starts doing the job that he was supposed to do the whole time. That to me is a little bit of a red flag, meaning where the hell was this before? You should have been doing this the whole time, and you didn't. Now, what's bygone is bygone. Now it is what it is. So wherever this situation has fallen, if the guys believe that they're playing right now for Miguel Cairo, and Miguel Cairo is what's getting the wins, and this is what brings out the best in them, so be it. Guys are going to believe that, then you got to believe it. It's true. If they don't, then it's not true. But that's the thing about baseball players is if they believe it is something, whether they believe it's La Russa being out or maybe it's, you know, win to go spite, you know, I don't know, Dallas, you know, what's
Dallas
his name?
Dallas Keuchel
or something, right?
Dallas Keuchel, yeah.
I mean, this is what they're doing. So I mean, it's not as cut and dry as fans obviously know, because fans don't know dick about what goes on in a clubhouse. The clubhouse is by definition exclusive. You're not invited. You're not a part of the club, so you don't get to know what goes on in the clubhouse. Neither do we. In case we get an occasional person that tells us a little bit about what goes on in the clubhouse, but we'll never know the whole story of a clubhouse because that's what it is. It's a legitimately isolated group, and we're not a part of it. And that's what makes it a clubhouse. It's exclusive.
And yes. So, and I want to respond to a couple of the comments from Baloney Fonseca, a.k.a. Peter Fonseca, our friends at the Chicago Sports Bums. By the way, they're having a tailgate in a couple of weeks, and I hear there's going to be some awesome bourbon out there to sample.
Ooh.
Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. He says, I blame Han a lot more than I blame TLR. I am 100% with you, and I have been on the Fire Rick Hahn bandwagon for as long as I could remember. He is the one who saddled Tony La Russa with two first basemen / DH as outfielders. He is the one who knew they had to address issues in right field and second base after last year's playoff loss and did nothing. He is the one who went out and spent all this money on relievers and needed to go get more.
He is the one who is the ball licker. Oh, wait, sorry.
Yes, exactly.
Sorry.
You know,
if I could think of on that one.
Yes. And the thing with La Russa, someone, and this is not about La Russa specifically, but it's about his type of person. Somebody doesn't get to that level without having drive and ego. And sometimes you need someone else to put that drive and ego in check or in timeout or however the hell you want to say it. This is a time where I honestly believe that Jerry needs to step in and say, Tony, I think you should call it a day. It's not because The team's playing better without you. It has nothing to do with that. But you got a fucking pacemaker, and you need to take it easy in your late 70s so that you're around for a long time. That's just my personal opinion on it. Mm-hmm. I don't think he should lose. It's like the old saying in baseball. You can't lose your job because of injury.
Right.
And let me also throw this out for people. The Twitterazzi has no problem just harping on Tony La Russa. Oh, look what they've done since La Russa's been gone. Who else has been gone from this team in the same time frame? I don't hear a fucking word about anyone saying Tim Anderson's not there. He's been gone the same time frame too. Do you think maybe this coincides with Elvis coming, you know, Elvis being in the building instead of leaving the building?
And, you know,
you think maybe that's part of it too?
You bring up a good point, and I don't want to point any fingers, especially at the cap, that you know, the straw that stirs the drink in TA's case. But let's be honest, this season has been one distraction after another, off the field stuff with Tim Anderson, with the stuff going on with his wife and on the Instagram chick, and then the other stuff going on, and then the drama during the All-Star game, her coming, like, there's a lot of crap going on that it has felt like to me that there's been a dark cloud, a big dark rain cloud that's been following Tim Anderson all season long. He still does his job, but that's not all of the work in a team sport. Doing your job isn't enough. There are other jobs. You need to help others get their job done too, and you need to be a teammate. And you know, I can't, again, this is a clubhouse. We don't know what goes on in the clubhouse. It is, again, I can't stress to enough how exclusive it is. And so what goes on for real in there is very, very much privileged information. And, you know, you have to look at all different things and put a finger on it. If we're going to use the Tony La Russa's not here and the Sox are winning and call that logic, then one has to also then say that if we were to look at Tim Anderson's absence as being some sort of catalyst for them winning, that would also then, I would say, fall under that kind of logic. Is it true? Probably not.
We don't know.
Yeah,
we don't know.
We don't know. Like, but you look at all the angles. You look at every factor, not just the Tony La Russa factor. The only people that are looking only at the Tony La Russa factor are the ones you just addressed earlier, which those are the ones that are unhinged. They have that Tony La Russa.
They're blinded by hatred for La Russa.
Yeah.
That's all that it is.
So the logic, you know, is out the window
could,
there.
He could donate $1 million to charity and people would complain that it wasn't $2 million.
Yep. And that's their cross the bear. That's not ours. And when you're using logic and you're using common sense, that's not their strong suit anyway. So it's, again, Tony La Russa won 93 games last year, basically with the same roster, minus one or two players. So all of a sudden, it doesn't just disappear. There's a lot more to go, and there are a lot more factors in this, and there's depth, and there's been health, and there's been a lot of things. But, you know, if you're going to look at Tony La Russa being gone as one of the, you know, why they're winning, well, then you got to look at the other one too. And, you know, and that brings me to the next big thing is you brought up Elvis Andrews. The pickup of Elvis Andrews was one of, if probably between that or Cueto, the two best moves that Rick Hahn made. Yep. Now, does that save his job? No. That's him picking, that's him shooting himself in the foot and bandaging the foot. But you can also tip your cap and say that the Elvis Andrews, putting him on a contender, has done wonders for the dude, as he as he has shown to be a veteran catalyst. He's been playing great. He's done really well for the White Sox. He has, you know, a big homer the other night. And again, when the Sox picked him up, we've talked about this here on the show. We talked about it on the Pinwheels and Ivy as well. I've been ringing this bell for Elvis Andrews the second that this move happened. When he was DFA and he was available, we were ringing this bell from the start. Yes. And this is why, because this is a guy that comes into the clubhouse that's going, I have been stuck in a dead up to the neck ball club for long enough, and all of a sudden I'm in a contender. This is the stuff that happens to certain players, and they wake up and they can help bring a team. Elvis Andrews was a stud in his heyday. He was a stud.
Yes, he was.
And so getting,
he was a number
stud
one prospect.
Yes,
wasn't
he was.
He?
Absolutely was. Yep. Yeah. And Drew Robinson actually could never find himself at short because Elvis
neither could Profar, if I remember correctly.
Like, so he's been there, man, and he's good, and this is a big pickup. So I mean, this pickup, I know Cueto didn't throw too well today, but you know, he's allowed to not have a good game once in a while. But you've got guys that are now in this locker room that are not just, they're leading. They're not just there to do their job. They're helping everybody else with their job. They're carrying people over the finish line as opposed to waving them saying, come on, they're going, get on my shoulders, let's fucking go. And these are the things that help create a winning mentality in a locker room. And this is where, again, I'm not saying it's Tim Anderson, just like I won't say it's Tony La Russa. Because we don't know. We can't. There's no quantitative data that you could pull out of your ass that will tell you yes or no in this. It's and all let me, perception and subjectivity.
I'm going to stop you at one point there. One point. Where you said there's no quantitative data that you can show that it's one way or the other. I don't think the data fucking matters in this case. We're not in the locker room.
Right.
We don't know what the relationships are like. You know, for every – and I'm going to – go into baseball geek mode for a second here. For every early 70s Oakland A's team that it was widely known they hated each other. And I know for a fact because I sat next to one of the Hall of Famers who was asked the question, what was Reggie like? And the exact quote was, he was an asshole. Then I asked another one, what was Reggie like? He was an asshole. They were on different teams with Reggie and hated him. So that dynamic does work, but it's very rare when it works like that. I mean, I'll use a great example. The 2004 Cubs. That was a team that hated everybody and everything. I mean, they were arguing with Stone and was Chip Carey, right? They were arguing with Stone and Chip Carey on the TV broadcasts. You know, they were, weren't they calling up like the scorers to have scoring rulings
changed. They were like pissed off at the official score. They were at the shit show. Dusty Baker let the wheels come off.
Right. Now, that was very public because they went after the broadcasters. So we know a little bit more about that. We don't know what's going on in the locker room. And to your point of what you said a couple minutes ago, you know, the feedback you get is they like each other. And there's, you know, Abreu has talked about how great Tony has been to play for. Now, Abreu also said Ricky Renteria was great to play for. You can, if you're asked that question, how is Tony to play for? If you think he's not great, I don't think you're saying he's great. I don't think you're trying to toe the company line, if you will. You're going to say, you know, he's the manager. He makes the lineup. We go out there and play. Something along those lines. I don't, and TA, the same thing, you know, the same thing. He's talked about Tony being great to play for. So they're undoing it. They're doing it to themselves if they're lying and saying he's great to play for when he's really not great to play for.
Exactly. Well, that's it doesn't matter what they say anyway. I mean, like, I mean, look at the tweets that come out. As soon as Jose Abreu goes out and defends and says, they like Tony La Russa, the immediate response is, well, he just has to say that because it's his boss. Like, well, then what is this? What is the whole debate about then? You can't have this conversation because it doesn't matter.
Well, that's sports radio.
Yeah. And so
that's radio.
It's fodder. They want fodder.
You know, and I'll be honest with you. There's a certain show, and I'm not going to name it, that it's getting to the point where I can only listen to it one day a week because no matter what happens, you know, Rick Hahn. Now, why the fuck isn't Luis Robert on the IL? You know, he's played these games all years with these guys where he had them sit out 6-7 days where your roster's one man short. But yet, it's Tony's fault. No. The fault is on Rick Hahn for two reasons. One, he's playing games with the fucking roster. And two, where is all this depth that he talked about? You know, remember, he's going to have this continual pipeline of talent. Where's it at? It ain't there. You know, will Colson Montgomery be a stud? Hopefully. He looks like he's got the tools for it. But until the day he arrives and shows it, it's kind of hard to say it.
That was also a no-brainer draft pick, too. Like, I mean, the Cubs are the ones that blew that one. The only reason that Montgomery was there in the first place is because the Cubs went and drafted Jordan Wicks.
Yes, you were leading the charge on that.
Yeah, that was he had no choice.
You were furious.
Yeah, and so Hahn, I mean, it's basically that was a hitting a bullseye from, you know, 1 inch away. That was not a hard move to make. But, you know, when you talk about depth and we stay out of White Sox Cubs business.
Did he hit the scoreboard on that kick?
I think he did. I think he hit the top of the little thing. Yep. I'm saying got a little air on that one. I got some air for that.
Just
but
a little.
So, you know, when we talk that, it's a good little segue now. I mean, because again, as we go down the stretch, you know, the next time we come back, we're going to basically be in the final week of the season here in two weeks when we come back for our next podcast. So a lot of stuff can happen in between now, but before we transition over a little bit,
that's not good.
Before we transition a little over to the Cubs, what do you think you're going to see over the next 2 weeks in between now and our next broadcast 2 weeks from now? What do you think, how do you think this is going to play out when we come back in 2 weeks? Where do you think the White Sox, Guardians, Indian or Twins, whatever, where do you think that division is going to be? Where do you think the White Sox are going to be? What's your prediction 2 weeks from now when we come back? Where are the White Sox going to be?
I think the Guardians are going to win the division. I think the White Sox are going to do the White Sox thing. They're going to lose the first two games of the four and then win the next two. So it's a net neutral of zero in the standings. That's what I think. I don't trust this team against the Guardians because they haven't showed it. And again, it's another case where you just sit there and you go, you know, I'm sick. I told you and Zvo and Yumper this about a month ago in a text. I really want to put together a post or, end of season press conference bingo card with all the fucking excuses you're going to hear. Injuries, weather, you know, it was early, you know, all this crap you're going to hear. Players didn't play to the back of their baseball cards. Yeah, all this crap you're going to hear because that's what you're going to hear. Now, I'm hearing grumblings that if the White Sox don't make the playoffs, there will be some reorganization done. Keyword, reorganization, not firings, reorganization. So Rick Hahn will probably be promoted in the true respect of the Dilbert principle, rising to the level of his incompetence. And I just, unfortunately, if, let's say they want to bring in Jeremy Haber as the next general manager or Chris Getz as the next general manager, I'm going to ask you one question. What team has reached out to the White Sox to ask for permission to interview them?
So wait, repeat that.
Okay, let's say Hahn gets promoted
In
true Dilbert White Sox principal fashion. They're going to probably consider Jeremy Haber and Chris Getz, who are the assistant GMs. Do you know of any team that has reached out to the White Sox asking to interview them for that position?
No, right? I mean,
that's my point.
Oh, but yeah.
Guys were good,
they would be going out of.
You have other teams coming to ask for permission to interview them.
Yeah, you're not a hot commodity by any means. There's right. It's kind of like the Patrick Wisdom trade deadline.
Yes.
Concept. We know what his value is everywhere else outside of the Chicago Cubs organization.
Yep.
Because a guy with a team-friendly contract at the trade deadline didn't even get a single tire kicked about his availability when. With a team-friendly contract and quote-unquote performances, people realize that the numbers are skewed and they are inaccurate as far as trying to decide worth and value. So that's the kind of thing with the White Sox. And we've talked about it on the show a ton. They need to get out of house and really kind of push and bring in outside voices because the old and while Theo Epstein is not an option as a person to do that, he could be a team owner. If Reinsdorf were to sell, that would be something. That's the only time you're going to get a guy like Theo. Now he's done with that kind of role. He wants to be a team owner. That's the only next progressive step for him. Everything else is not it's a step down and he's not going to do anything. That's not a better than parallel move. And so
with Theo, it's either he's got two tracks, commissioner or ownership. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two tracks.
Or traveling tour rock band as well.
Yes, there you go.
But with that, as a good segue, kind of transition, we'll do a really short Cubs. We don't have to go too long on the Cubs. But speaking of Theo, the Cubs, the Cubs on the White Sox end, the White Sox are possibly going to be, maybe dancing, but pretty close. And they're inside the window, joy or not, enjoying the ride or not. But, mm-hmm. you know, with the Cubs, we're at a different spot as Cub fans. And we're at a spot where some of us knew we were at. But, you know, Jed Hoyer refused to say the word rebuild. But we are in year two of a rebuild, of strip down. And, you know, if it starts today, you know, we know one of the main reasons that they did some of the stripping down was so that the Cubs, you know, ownership had some liquid cash for this, that bid that they had for the soccer team that they lost to, again, of course, the Dodgers ownership group. But today, Tom Ricketts ran his mouth, came out, and it's such a weird, it just, he just says he's such a piece of shit. I can't really, there's no other way to describe it. I mean, he's been all this other stuff. Let me just read you a quote. And then I'm going to read his quote today. So he says, "We support your support." Hold on. I messed this up. There it is. Okay. Where is this at? What the hell? Let me make sure I'm reading that. It's just a segment from. Okay, here it is. Yeah, we're focused on replenishing our farm system and reloading our roster to build our next great Cubs team. Blah, blah, blah. Your support is critical to our success. I want to thank you for your incredible loyalty now through the years. During a season without fans due to COVID, you remain committed to your team. Blah, blah, blah. You're extremely patient as we work to build a championship roster and restore Wrigley Field. You believed our... we believed in our plan to win and trusted our deliver our commitment to play championship baseball in the greatest ballpark of America. We did, and I assure you we will do it again. We understand it might take a little time to process these changes as we integrate new players, blah, 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 blah. Basically, it's him saying we're going to spend, we're going to make it, we're going to put together the best roster this year. And now, today, Tom Ricketts, and I quote, "The fact is you can't buy a championship team in baseball. You have to build it, and that's what we're doing."
You know what? Well, I hear those two quotes, and there's something that immediately jumps out to me on that second quote. No chance they're going after Correa or Turner or Bogarts.
I mean, if they do, they're going to have to play third. Because there's a gold glove shortstop there right now.
But that message tells me it's trying to taper expectations so people aren't expecting them to go after that high end, those high end free agents. That's mm-hmm. what that message tells me.
I mean,
and again, I'm using years of White Sox experience because I've heard all these lines before. That's what that message is saying.
Oh, and the thing is, here's him who, you know, again, at the beginning of the season said that we're going to be using our resources, every resource available to us to put together a winning team this year, 2022, blah, blah, blah. The Cubs are 25 games under 500. And Tom Ricketts says that he considers the 2022 season, and I quote, a success. So how are you telling us at the beginning of the season that you're going to put all your resources into winning team now in 2020 when there's 25 games under 500 and you're calling this season a success? This is nothing, not a success at the major league level. It's a success organizationally because they did, you know, they a couple of their prospects got a year older, but they've done nothing to improve their on-field product in 2022. They did nothing to really improve their product for 2023. And this is the problem that we have. And you said it, if they don't get Correa or a Bogarts or a Turner, if they don't go out and get big money players in this offseason, how can fans look themselves in the mirror and pretend that this isn't a big giant grift and a big giant con? And when you see him, he talks out of both sides of his mouth because he's a shitbag. But this is Tom Ricketts. This is what you have when you have an owner that was willing to utilize his own media contacts to help sabotage value of his own players so that, you know, by saving money, they could let these players go with less of a lashback by the fans.
Backlash.
And so, you know, he does with what he says today, completely lays it at the foot of Jed Hoyer to spend the money. He's basically saying that he has given Jed everything that he needs and it's up to Jed to get it done. He basically now has not allowed Jed to operate. And now he's saying that the ball's in Jed's court. Like, it's like, this guy's such a shitbag. He's such a douche canoe that he literally ties Jed up and then tells Jed, tells everybody it's up to Jed to, you know, to put the ball in the bucket, even though he's tied up. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me, but Cup fans will they'll make excuses for it.
You're looking at it from the wrong perspective. You're looking at it from the wrong perspective. Don't look at it from a fan perspective. Look at it from a business perspective. Did they probably make more money than they anticipated they would based on the type of season they were going to have? Yes. What does that mean? It's a successful year. This is, as I've said to you before, this is the White Sox model. This is what Jerry Reinsdorf and company have been doing for 40 years. It's about, they don't, and I don't have any doubt that Jerry Reinsdorf wants to win. Don't have any doubt about that. But you know what he wants more? To make money. That's priority number one. You know, and people would always come after me when I'd say this following statement. I would love to have had George Steinbrenner owning the White Sox. I would think you would love to have had George Steinbrenner owning the Cubs. Why? Because there was never a doubt on his number one goal being to win. Mm-hmm. Now, he made terrible moves sometimes in trying to accomplish that, but there was never a doubt that that was the ultimate goal.
Yep,
it wasn't. Can you truly say that about either side of town?
No, not at all. Absolutely not. You can't. Yeah. You can't. It's 100% about that investment. That's how he sold his father on giving Daddy Warbucks, giving them the money in the first place to buy the Cubs. You win or lose, Cubs could be dead last, which they basically are, and you're still have 30,000 people packing the place. It's a low floor or a high floor, high ceiling kind of investment where you know you're going to win that investment.
It's a low floor, high ceiling.
Yep.
I mean, low floor being, we could still be in last place, but pack, you know, 2 million plus people in.
Yep. And attendance is down a little bit.
High ceiling, we could get 3 million in.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And attendance is down a little bit this year, but it's not. Yeah. Cub fans have not shown their disdain for the ownership's moves by not showing up to the ballpark. They've been enabling it, to be honest. And I know Yumper feels the same way. It's one of those types of things. You know, I'm currently not buying any Cubs products. I refuse to right now. Okay, actually, I'm spending my money on Bear stuff because I believe that the Bears currently are actually operating in a manner that as I approve of. I mean, they got 123 in salary cap space next year. I'm stoked. So I think that they're currently operating as they should. And so I'm happy to give my money to the organizations that are, I feel they are. Cubs organization, I don't want to give a dime to. It is what it is. But, you know, with that said, and there are some positives with the Cubs, you know, as much as I'm frustrated with with Tom Ricketts being, a canoe of douche, there's a really bright future, you know, starting with my guy, Nico Hoerner, who I've been a huge fan of since before he was even drafted with the Cubs out of Stanford. He could very well be the Gold Glove winner this year. I know he just came out of the game tonight. I think he tweaked, I think maybe his groin or something. So he left the ball game tonight. Hope he's okay. But he has been playing.
He yanked his wank?
Maybe.
Is what you're saying? He yanked his wank?
No more hanky, my wanky. So hopefully he's okay. But his performance at shortstop this year, analytically, he is the best shortstop in baseball this year. The year after Cub, some certain meatball sections of Cub fandom were like, oh my God, what are we going to do without Javi at shortstop? Well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to have a higher fielding percentage because he's going to actually field the routine ground balls and not try and get cute and do a no look snag flip toss fire into the fourth row of the upper deck. So we have a Gold Glover in Nico Hoerner, a dude who plays hard, works his ass off. It's exciting to see. And then you got the future of these guys that are going to be coming up here in 2024, probably maybe in 2023, a few of them, like when you talk about Brennan Davis, the Cubs guy that they got for Scott Efros in the Yankees trade was Hayden Wesneski. And he had his major league debut the other night and he was fantastic. They brought him in relief and he went 5 innings of relief, was just dominant. And he carved. So that's been fantastic. That's good to see. A couple of the guys they've brought up before, other younger guys struggled a little bit, but you've got Pete Crow Armstrong coming up. He's going to be a finalist for minor league player of the year for across the board. He's having video game numbers in the minors. Matt Mervis at AAA, who I have no idea why the Cubs haven't brought him up yet. At this point, he's still sitting there at AAA. We have no idea if this guy's going to be a good ball player at the major league level or if he's just a AAA warrior. I know guys that have hit 400 at AAA and couldn't hit 200 at the major league level. So it's not like
Daniel Palka.
Chad Hermanson hit literally 400 for the Las Vegas, whatever team it was at the time. I don't think we were the 51s.
Was it the 51s then, or was it the Aces?
I think it was the 51s. I think we weren't the Aviators, and I think it was before we were Las Vegas Stars were before that, but I think it was 51s. But Chad hit 400 here, and then he went up to the Dodgers and couldn't hit 200. I mean, it happens. It's not the same thing. And yeah, Roosevelt Brown, good call there. Yeah, and so that's the big part of it. No chance to see this guy at the major league level. Not sure what they're doing. So we're not sure if this Matt Mervis guy is anything. But I mean, if you look at his numbers, my God, Pete, at AAA this year, just at the minor league level this year, he's hit 32 jacks, 109 RBIs. He's hit .313. He's got an OPS of .992. Scored 80 runs. He's a left-handed bat, first baseman. He's a former 39th round pick with the Nationals. Just got DFA'd right before, I think it was a COVID casualty, and he just didn't get a good look. And I mean, ever since he's been with the Cubs, he's been just insane. I mean, his numbers at AAA, specifically at AAA, he was called up. He had 11 jacks, 29 RBIs, hit .305, and he in 43 games there at AA. Every single level he's been at, he's had basically the same stats, which is fantastic. But he hasn't been called up, so we'll see there. But between him, Wisniewski, Brennan Davis is back, starting to get. He's had back surgery, earlier this year, so he's starting to get a couple at bats here and there. I think he had a jack the other day. So the future is bright with the Cubs. It is, but it ain't now, and it ain't a major league product. And so there's a lot that has to happen now in this offseason. But the Cubs are, they're going to finish. They're not going to lose 100 games this year. So I guess we can say, yay, good on that. I'm so glad that so many
fans your victory.
Put so much money into their pockets to watch a 30-game under 500 team. But it is what it is. And we are now moving into the offseason as Cub fans, expecting this offseason to be a busy offseason, spending money. But that, again, yes, that comment by Ricketts tells me all I need to know about what he thinks this next great Cubs team will be. How it we built, which is, you're not going to spend my money
cheap
draft. Yeah. You're not, you can't buy a winning team. That's literally, like you said, he's setting the road up to not spend again. He's telling us what he wants, and we need to listen to what he's telling us the truth. And we're going to need to believe him and not make excuses for this, trench mouth. So that said, speaking of, as we move away from the Cubs and my ire towards good old Tom Ricketts, one thing I really wish I had was three wishes. And why do I say three wishes? Because yesterday I got to go see 3,000 Years of Longing by George Miller. And you would know George Miller. If George Miller, you were a fan of Mad Max.
Warrior, right?
Yeah, Fury Road. He won 6 Oscars. And this is his new film. I didn't know it was a George Miller. Carrie wanted to see it. And it's got Idris Elba and Tilda Swinton. And basically he's a djinn, which is like a genie. And she finds him in a bottle. And it's basically she's an author that's a really a seclusive author. And she occasionally has hallucinations of demonic beings. And so basically push comes to shove. She opens up a bottle and ta-da, there comes gigantic Idris Elba. And it's a whole genie in a bottle kind of thing. And so, yeah, if I had three wishes, I think I would, one of them would be Cubs related. But for now, the film itself, Carrie wanted to see it. My fiance wanted to see it. And I was like, oh, let's go. Sure. It's a genie movie. It'd be cool. And then, yeah, the opening credits comes on. It says George Miller. I'm like, holy crap. This is fantastic. It's a George Miller film. And so it started pretty good. I think I texted you guys, actually. I went to go to the restroom, and I texted them, like, this so far has been pretty fantastic. It's, like, artistic. The visuals are great. I regret saying that text. I think I jinxed you. I jinxed it. Because when I returned from the bathroom, the rest of the movie was aesthetically well done. Cinematography, well done. Mm-hmm. Plot-wise, I was ready to stab my eyes out. Carrie fell asleep. she's like, I feel like this movie, it felt like we were watching the Irishman, right? Like 4-hour movie. And I'm like, my God, how much longer? And then I look at the time, the movie's only 1 hour and 48 minutes long. I'm like, it feels like I've been here. I feel like I've aged 1,000 years and I have 3,000 years of longing that I wish I could get back. The movie, it failed down the stretch. It turned into a horrible movie. And we actually joked all day yesterday, like, it had a good idea. It really did. And Tilda Swinton's fantastic. And obviously, so is Idris Elba or whatever. But God, the plot. I mean, it just, again, I mean, I get it. I get what he's trying to do. I get what George Miller was trying to say. It's based on a story called The Djinn in a Nightingale's Eye. And it does talk about careful what you wish for and all stuff. There's a lot of obese nudity, I guess as you put it. Like 300, 350 pound nude women, a lot in the film. In fact, I know, and I'm not judging either way, but I was like, oh, I was like, okay. And there's like an orgy, with one character. I'm like, whoa, okay. Not what I thought I'd see today. But if, then you think about George Miller and you think about his films, and he actually does that even in Fury Road. He doesn't body shame. Your body's your body. And so he actually does that. Like, I'm like, oh, it's George Miller. What the hell am I? Of course. But the film itself, not great. The visuals, again, fantastic. The cinematography by John Seale was great. So that's a plus. Plot wise, though, it starts strong and just it fades, and it gets to the point where you're checking your watch. Again, Carrie took a nap. She doesn't even know how long she slept. I'm like, well, it couldn't be too long. The movie's only an hour and 48 minutes long. So it did flop at the box office, though. It was $60 million budget, and it's made $9 million. So not great. But you got to see something way better than 3,000 Years of Longing, but it may be something that was 30 some odd years old. And what did you see?
40
years 40. Old. You got to see.
Yes. A God bless Fathom Events. I am a sci-fi geek. And last week, and for those who don't know, Fathom Events does Turner Classic Movies, TCM at the Movies. And every month they show a quote unquote classic movie for a couple of screenings at the theaters. And the selection for early September was by far, I would say, the best movie of its sequence, if you will. Or it was Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. So yes, Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan was on the big screen, and I did have to go see it. It took me back 40 years to actually going to see it at Ford City. I remember going to see it at Ford City in the summer of 1982. And it just was, it was amazing to see, because the things you were blown away by back then, you're like, oh, that's quaint, you know, looking at it now. But any chance you get to see William Shatner scream "Khan!" at the top of his voice with that ridiculous facial expression,
that wonderful perm,
you got to take advantage of it.
Absolutely. But
I will say, later this month, I forget the exact dates, but fathomevents.com, they are showing Poltergeist, which also is 40 years old.
And a rare thing that people don't know about this, well, some people do, is that, yes, technically it wasn't based on the credits, but that's actually a Steven Spielberg-directed film. But due to the, I want to say the Directors Guild strike or something, he didn't take the credit. But the director of the film has said in the past, I did not direct that movie. Spielberg directed it.
Yeah,
he just basically told me what to do. So, like, that's a Spielberg film coming back, which is makes sense because it was produced by Spielberg anyway. But it is really directed by Spielberg, and you can see it when you see like the dolly zoom when she's running down the hallway. All the Spielberg-esque trademarks are there. Speaking of though,
I'll say this about Fathom Events real quick. Hmm? There are two events coming up later in this year that I am, if schedule permits, I am definitely going to try and jump on in November. They are showing the 60th anniversary. It's the 60th anniversary of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Ooh.
So you could go see To Kill a Mockingbird on the big screen. And if you want to see who the number one hero of all time in film history was voted on, guess who it was?
Gary Busey?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was, I can't think of his name, Gregory Peck in Lawrence To Kill a Mockingbird.
Lawrence of Arabia?
Yeah. Who, by the way,
Gregory you're talking about Atticus Finch? Actor, you're talking about Atticus Finch being the greatest?
Atticus Finch was the number one hero. But To Kill a Mockingbird, Gregory Peck won Best Actor. Same year, Lawrence of Arabia won Best Picture, beating To Kill a Mockingbird.
Uh-huh. Now, if you are a fan of...
And then in December, they are showing It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, that'll be a good one too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there is a sequel to Kill Mockingbird, and it's Atticus Finch doesn't come across as he's older now in it. Yeah. And Scout is obviously a young woman, and she comes back home, and yeah, he's a little bit of a racist towards the end, but he's like, it's not necessarily a racist, he's just old and set in his ways kind of thing. Right. And it's kind of like, I think
she published that book like 40 years later, didn't she?
She wrote it actually. Yeah. She wrote that as like the intro before. Yeah. The, Mockingbird itself was actually the second of what she wrote. Ghost at a Watchman was actually the original, and it was her as an older person. And then I believe one of her editors said, why don't you write about this one? Cause there was a little segment about like everything that happened with the trial. And her editor was like, why don't you write about that? Make that like a central core part of a whole nother story, you know, novella. And that's really where she came across, and Harper Lee wrote the classic book that's banned, the one of the most frequently banned books in the United States educational system. That, Catcher in the Rye, and Of Mice and Men. Those are the three most frequently banned books. If you are a fan, it's crazy to think.
Catcher in the Rye.
But it just makes it's weird to think that you're like, ah, really? Like Of Mice and Men, really?
But yeah. Catcher in the Rye because of some of the language in there.
Oh, yeah. They drops the F-bomb twice. He says GD, I think, 124 times. But
is that all? I think it's more than that.
I had it on account for when I teach it because, again, when I read with my class, I do read the end when he reads the kid scratched, you know, when the kid wrote fuck you on the wall. And he reads it, and I'm always like, I'm like, I can't wait to say it in class. And I'm like, and I hold the F out. I'm like, fuck you. And I'm like, yeah. So I'm like, sorry. I'm like, English. but yeah, so that came out. And yeah, speaking of classics, on Monday on the Labor Day, the day of labor, I did not labor. Mm-hmm. I went to the IMAX theater and in a 4K IMAX remastered.
Remastered.
Got to watch Jaws on the big screen on the IMAX, which was fantastic. And so that was a neat experience. I can't remember if you got a chance to go see it yet. It's there for another week, I believe. It's still there for one more week, at least here in IMAX. But to see, I mean, honestly, I couldn't wait to see the Dolly Zoom scene at the beach. But, you know, seeing that in an IMAX and the large, I was the only person in the theater,
just so everybody knows, the Dolly Zoom scene is where Brody is sitting and the wife's massaging his shoulders, right?
It's when the kid,
if I remember,
they're just chilling on the beach and he's just kind of, he's paranoid as it is.
And she's massaging him, I believe. And that's when the shark attacks
the little kid
mm-hmm. and you see his body jump up.
Yeah. And then
you see the blood it zooms in on him.
Yep. And it does the Dolly Zoom. If you guys don't know what a Dolly Zoom is, it's the pushing and pulling motion of a camera. So in other words, the cinematographer is either zooming with the lens and pulling back with the dolly. So it's zooming in on the picture while pulling away with the extra camera rig, or vice versa. It's pushing in with the camera rig and going back and unzooming with the lens itself. So it creates a pushing and pulling motion. They call it the vertigo move, which if you've seen, what is it? The movie Vertigo from Alfred Hitchcock. What they utilize the vertigo for. What's his name's character? Jimmy Stewart's character. And if you see it, he almost falls off a roof at the beginning. So he has vertigo, and that dolly zoom that's the technique from that film that became a real popular technique. You see it in film all the time. It usually showcases someone if it's showcasing stress or some sort of suspenseful moment that it's the look. And so here's, I think if I can get it to pull up, we actually do this as a project with my students. I love it. I have the students, we do a Jaws unit and they have to recreate a scene from Jaws shot for shot, but they also do a scene where they, let's see here if I can get this thing off here.
Before you show it, mm-hmm. when you have them recreate the scene shot for shot, do you have anyone going underwater? At the boat?
We have had, so I kid you not. Oh, darn it. Oh, there we go. Got it off there. I have had some kids they film it in their pool at their homes. And so as a result, hold on, let me get this thing. And so they do, yeah. And but here's the kicker. I taught George Tarkanian's grandson.
Jerry Tarkanian.
Or Jerry Cardian, what did I just say? Anyway, yeah. So I coached his son, Alex. And Alex in the project actually played a shark. He pops out of water and goes, "Arr, I'm a shark." And of course, if you know, Tark was the shark. So that was like his old nickname. So Jerry's got that. So I thought that was pretty funny. But he's like, "Arr, I'm a shark." I'm like, "You dork." Where is this? See, I can't grab this. Oh, this is bothering me. I'm trying to grab this. Well, I'm trying to like.
Yeah.
Let me just do this.
And then points to Peter Fonseca, who proceeds to tell us he still has Shakes the Clown on DVD.
As you
My should. Hat's off to you.
Yeah. I. Here we go. All right. So here's the dolly zoom from Jaws. For those of you that are not familiar with it, this is the scene from Jaws. Here's the dolly zoom.
Here it comes. There it is.
That, right there. And if you notice how in the picture, it's the pushing and pulling. It's just the pushing and pulling of the lens in and out. Pushing with the lens and pulling back with the dolly or vice versa. But it's a cool little effect. Not as cool as Shakes the Clown, of course, obviously. But it was great to see, though. It was fun to see Jaws in the theater. You know what I really did notice, though, is how the dialogue, like, again, I've seen this movie like 250 times. I mean, I teach it 4 times a year in my class, like with 4 different classes. And sometimes you don't hear everything. And when you're in that IMAX theater and you're, same thing happened with ET, but when I saw ET a couple weeks ago in IMAX, but when you're logged in there and you're just, you're keyed in, you're off your phone, the audio is way good, right? You've got better audio and you hear the side conversations. And I had never heard all these little side conversations during the meeting when they meet with the rest of the people from the town, and that's when Quint pops up and scratches the, you know, tells the whole town, "We're gonna kill, I'm gonna kill the shark for you for 10 grand or whatever. I'm at the head, the tail, the whole damn thing." And the that whole scene, though, you don't hear all these conversations. You hear, there's one dude, by the way, I can't unsee him now. He just stands there creepily, and I never noticed him before. But you can also hear them talking about like how it's going to affect their jobs and their businesses if they're
4th of July, it might as well be the end of the year.
Yeah, exactly. And but you hear their little chatter, and I never heard the chatter between everybody because it wasn't that clear on watching it, you know.
Yes,
I haven't seen it in theater in years, and so that was really cool because you can hear some of these little side discussions. I'm like, oh my god, like it really made more sense to me. It really made more sense to me about the politics. I can't wait to teach it again in a couple of weeks. It's actually, I think, in 3 weeks where we start the unit. But it was so fun to see on the big screen and to remind yourself the genius of that film and what he had to do to make the film. I mean, you think about it, 1974 when they started filming, I believe it was 74. They went over budget by like it was $13 million, I think, which was the most expensive movie ever made at the time, which is, we kind of laugh at that now. It is the summer blockbuster, the first summer blockbuster. They call it the golden, you know, not the golden era, the new age, of cinema or whatever. And you have, you know, the shark breaking down. So, you know, he had to, you know, Spielberg had to figure out a way to shoot around the shark. And so he used psychological tools, like never seeing the shark really until the end. And they named the Shaws Bruce, the shark. And they joked around, they called the movie Flaws because it was like they would be filming and, you know, film would get water, you know, filming on the film would get hit with water and it would, you know, ruin the film. Or, you know, boats would just drift into the background during a scene because they're on the ocean. And like, so they were like, I think, 60 some odd days over their shot, their schedule too. It was real, just rough. And it almost killed Spielberg's career. I mean, it really did. He wasn't a nobody at the time, but obviously the film, you know, he hated this is another thing people don't realize. He hated the soundtrack. John Williams had to sit him down and tell him, "Dude, just trust me. You want this music." Spielberg wasn't a fan of the soundtrack, which is iconic now, but such a great.
You hear that? Dun, 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 dun. Everyone knows.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the good, the bad, and the ugly music. Yeah. Everyone knows.
Absolutely. And you play that shit when someone's in the pool and everyone's getting out of the water. Everyone knows.
Yep.
Or you start humming that song and then you put your head underwater and put your hands above your head like this. And then your friends think you're an idiot and they punch you underwater and you almost drown because you think you're going to. Well,
the funniest thing about that, I saw an interview with Richard Dreyfuss.
And he said he thought, how did he put it? He didn't think the movie was going anywhere until they saw the first screening.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he walked out of there screaming to Roy Scheider, he did it. Spielberg did it.
Yep.
That's all he would say. Spielberg did it.
Here's a couple things too. And if you didn't know this, but Hooper and Brody's wife in the book have an affair. Yeah. And that scene at the dinner table, I didn't notice it again until they are flirting heavy. I don't know if that was like something that they had possibly on a longer script that they were going to play on that. But I also noticed, isn't it funny that the sheriff, the chief of police, I didn't realize that he does this. He's drinking whiskey out of that tumbler, right? And it's got ice.
Yep.
And it's like that watered down part of the whiskey now at that point where you've drank most of the whiskey, but it's like, and then he just pours that bottle of wine directly on top of the ice. I'm like, ooh, it's so gross. But here's the sheriff, the chief of police getting hammered drunk. And then with this guy, and they go out on a boat drunk and they're eating snacks, drinking on the boat. Like, really, guys? Mm-hmm. So I thought that was kind of funny. And but that scene is so good. And again, when you see like the scene, it's a tiger shark. Oh, what? From the one guy, the guy on the dock. Oh, what? Just such a great. Yeah. And then gets behind the wheel. Right? But it's a great, if you get a chance, it's still in IMAX for another week. It's a great experience. Yeah. And if you've got kids that have never seen it, throw them in that theater and let them see it. Cause it's worth it.
There's one scene I think that absolutely has to be seen on the big screen, and that is the Indianapolis scene.
Oh yeah, and the shooting star.
That is just unreal. And they said Robert Shaw was drunk when he did it.
They were all drunk. All three of them. They were drunk.
Yep.
Yeah. That scene was one of the scenes because he was such a train wreck. Shaw was such a train wreck on the. The filming, they would find him in the gutter, passed out. He was at the tail end of his alcoholic spiral before his death. And he didn't, like, died like a year or two later.
Well, he made The Deep a couple years later, but I think, I want to say like 2 years tops.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Here we go. Let's see here. Yeah, but here's the line that you really want.
Yeah. For all those who are unaware, Jaws is one of the two books that I have maintained. The movie is better than the book.
Absolutely. And here's the line.
Check it again. So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945.
That scene right there is just why Robert Shaw was such a good... Yeah, that is a true story. And Robert Shaw is such a good performer. Like, that's such a tragedy that he didn't, you know... completely achieve his bliss, but you know, it's kind of like the same with Orson Welles.
And
same
people thing. And people forget that is the truth about the Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. It was carrying the Hiroshima bomb. It was a top secret mission. They did not send a distress call. Those soldiers were in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Fair game for any shark or any other creature that came up.
And there's some good books that kind of like novel version of what happened. And hearing some of the stories from the people that survived is just, it's just incredible. So just to think that humans went through that. And I mean, they would say, like, you'd look, you know, you go to bed at night and you look over at your buddy in the morning that you have all been floating and you say, hey, buddy, wake up. And he bobbles up and it turns out he's been completely eaten in half and he flips up and he's dead because he's been eaten in half, and so you only see the top half. And then finally when you like nudge him to wake him up, he flips around, you're like, oh hi, you're dead. So a lot of pain. But that's a real powerful scene, a really again, a great film. Spielberg is, in my opinion, you know, he's one of my favorite director of all time. He's top two or three. I'd probably put him at number one just for the sake of it all. But you know, it's a great opportunity, and I love that they're doing this. I know we're going to get like Rogue One's coming back to theaters now. We're going to get some of these Disney movies, now the D23 released.
Avatar in a couple weeks.
Yeah, got Avatar returning to IMAX 3D again, so you can see it in the 3D and IMAX the way that it was made the first time, which was fantastic. That was revolutionary at the time. Yes, it's Dances with Wolves in Space. I don't care. The technological achievements are fantastic. And then we've got, of course, coming in December, the actual sequel to... Avatar as well. So that's going to be really cool. And we got a lot of good films coming. This has kind of been a little bit more of a disappointing fall as far as releases are concerned, but we're about to ramp up again. And they're trying to get people back in theaters. You know, it doesn't help that sometimes some people are staying home because of the online release stuff, like Pinocchio I saw on Disney Plus last night. We watched that yesterday. It was fine. It was good. It's a very, very good Disney film. It's just, again, Tom Hanks plays Geppetto, and it's fun. You know, it's Pinocchio, for God's sakes. I mean, although the whale looks creepy as hell. It's not a whale. It's like got tentacles and shit. I don't know what that was, but they're just trying to get people back in the theater, though. So they did the $3 cinema thing last week, and it has been kind of an issue. I know Regal Entertainment, Regal Cinemas just filed for Chapter 11 earlier this week. So some of them are struggling. AMC is not, thank goodness, because that's my Stubbs list.
Well, AMC's got some weird stuff going on with short selling and stuff like that. It's one of the meme stocks.
Amazon was about to buy them, actually, before all that the crypto stuff happened. But anyway, so that's good. But I don't think there's really much else. I mean, we got a big week for the Cubs coming up, or the White Sox coming up. We've got the Bears got Packers week. So it's time to start immediately with your best Packer insults this year. It feels a little different. Maybe perhaps taunting is allowed this year because we're not going to get throttled by Aaron Rodgers. Don't hurt me again, but I'm believing it right now. I really am believing that Aaron Rodgers can't hurt us this year. Please show me on the doll where Aaron Rodgers touched me. So, you know, that's a big, big part of this week. You know, obviously the Cubs are just going to close out this mercifully end this season. Obviously got Game of Thrones tonight. The new Game of Thrones House of the Dragon has been great. If you're a big fan of that, I know the Lord of the Rings show has been fantastic. So a lot of good stuff on TV and whatnot.
And the Andor series starts in a couple weeks.
Starts too. Wednesday, I believe.
Is it Wednesday?
I think it's this week. I think September 18th, I think is the date. So,
okay.
So maybe not. Maybe next week. We got that coming. They got the new Disney. There are the new Star Wars animated film coming next month as well. That tells the story of like Dooku and like other stories. So it's like a cartoon by the guys that did Clone. It's by Dave Filoni who did Clone Wars and everything. So it looks pretty cool too. But other than that, I've got nothing really other than just be good people and take care of each other and enjoy this week and stay, you know, we're transitioning over to fall now. So the weather's are going to start getting nice. It's time to go out a little bit more here in the desert, at least. Yesterday, it was actually like 88 degrees, not face melt. So it was like crazy. I didn't feel like I was going to die when I walked outside. So that's good. But it's starting to get spooky season. So I'm starting to see the Halloween stuff coming up. We'll probably be doing a Halloween discussion here soon because evil doesn't die tonight, but it will die sooner or later on one of these nights. So for me, at least, thanks you guys for tuning in. I appreciate you guys a ton. And I know it's always a pleasure to get on here and talk with Pete. So Pete, why don't you give us our final thoughts and take us on out?
All right. As again, I echo everything my partner just said. Be nice to people. Sometimes the littlest nice gesture means a lot more than people can ever imagine. You know, we thank you for your time because time is truly the one asset you can never get back. So we thank you for taking the time to listen to us, to watch us if you were in the live feed. Thank you for your comments. Hopefully see all of you soon. Our time to see each other at the ballpark and everything else is drawing to a close, I should say. So hopefully you can get out there. We can shake hands and BS and everything else before then. But with that, once again, thank you for spending some time with us. And I will now turn it over to the wise man of the Tainted Glove. The one, the only. Yeah, dog, take it away. And aloha.
I would like to thank K-Fids and Aloha Mr. Hand giving me this opportunity to leave voicemails and being played on the Tainted Glove podcast network. I appreciate it. And I would also like to thank Pete for... Wait, what am I thanking Pete for? Someone DM me. Yeah, dog.